From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
In Illinois, we tried civil unions, and that separate status has time and time again proved to fall short. It is not an understood or legally recognized status. Civil unions have proved to be separate and unequal.
This bill goes directly to how I am defined, how my family is defined by this state. Whether Kelly and I can care for each other when we're sick, whether our family can be considered real.
This country was built on freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. And history is actually on the side of traditional marriage.
Those people are not homophobic, they are not bigoted, they are not biased, they are simply ordinary folks who hold values that they hold dearly.
Whose family unit will be destroyed by allowing two consenting adults who wish to get married to get married? That's just a bunch of rhetoric you have to say because if you're going to be opposed, you have to say something.
The quote that I offer is a quote from Pope Francis of the Roman Catholic Church, who is quoted as saying, "If someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and he has goodwill, who am I to judge?"
That's House Speaker Michael Madigan and others debating on the House floor this week as the Illinois legislature approved same-sex marriage. It's on its way to becoming law. Also, Pat Quinn picks Paul Vallis as his running mate. We'll talk about those issues on this edition of State Week. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Amanda Venicky, State House Bureau Chief for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio, Brian Mackey, State House Reporter, WUIS and IPR, our guest this week, John O'Connor, who covers the Capitol for the Associated Press. John, thanks for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
The Illinois legislature has sent to the governor. The governor has said he will sign it later this month, but same-sex marriage will become a reality in Illinois. Tell us about the at least two-hour debate that took place this week at the Illinois State Capitol, Brian Mackey.
Yeah, almost 2.5 hours. Everybody had a chance to talk who wanted to talk. There were some very heartfelt pleas from the handful of openly gay members of the General Assembly in the House talking about their family. We heard one of the clips from Representative Kelly Cassidy at the top of the show talking about how, you know, this was recognition for their family. Two of those people at least have partners. They have children together. There was actually a proposal. Representative Sam Yingling proposed to his partner later in the week this week. We can talk about that later. But this is something that the advocates have been pushing for about a year. You might remember back, I should say pushing hard in the legislature for about a year. Obviously, people have been working on the issue for longer than that. But it was back on Valentine's Day in the Senate when the Senate passed this legislation, but it kind of stalled out in the House, and people were very disappointed in May. A lot of people blame the sponsor for not getting it done at that time, but he slowly worked the roll call, as did Speaker Madigan and apparently Governor Quinn, and they were able to push it through.
And that sponsor, Greg Harris, as you mentioned, had faced criticism for not bringing that bill forth when they were unsure on the votes. I found it interesting that House Speaker Michael Madigan in that debate criticized those who were critical of Greg Harris and said they did not help, that they perhaps harmed the effort. I also found it interesting House Speaker Michael Madigan, who a week ago we were kind of questioning some of his political decisions of late, seemed to carry forth great political strength this time around in getting members of his Black Caucus to come aboard this legislation and ensure its passage.
Yeah, the speaker said that he helped sway the votes of between 5 and 10 legislators. There have been reports that it may or may not have been more. I think that this is one of those instances where, as we previously discussed, there are some legislators who he talked to, and I witnessed, coming into his office that ended up voting no. It is very much a question for many people of religion, of conscience, as well as of politics. But by being able, I believe, to provide political cover by showing the results of polls, and when you have someone like the speaker who has such a long history of success, obviously, in winning elections and running campaigns, talking to some of those people and telling them what he, after the vote, told members of the press corps, when he was asked, what about in elections? How will this turn out? The governor said, or pardon me, the governor, the speaker said, yeah, I think that it is wrong when people think that a yes vote for same-sex marriage is going to be a loss. He thinks it's the opposite. And so that had to have helped when he was speaking with those individuals. It wasn't just him, though. The governor, Pat Quinn, has also, I think this is one of those instances he's often known as not being one to have great relationships with legislators, not getting very involved. He's more, reactive than proactive typically. This is an instance where it appears that was not the case. He has also long been working this roll call, and it appears also that his administration may have really kind of used some of the strengths of, or at least the means made available to the state's chief executive in order to get some of those votes. And they haven't seen necessarily proof, but in talking to people, it appears as if there may have been promises of the things that have long been used to sway votes by governors, things like capital projects.
Bill, you mentioned the disappointment in May of the supporters of not having a roll call vote when Representative Harris decided not to call the vote. And, we had the sense going into this week that they would do a roll call regardless of whether it would fail, simply to appease those people. But I think there was, there were a lot of supporters very fired up. They saw how close they were. And but there was probably some political naivete at work in that disappointment in May, because when you put a roll call on the board and it fails, I mean, then people are put on the record. And, you can say on the one hand, well, we're going to force that person to say yes or to say no, but it also shows everybody else who's voting yes and who's voting no. And you could actually, if a vote failed, it only got 58 or 59 votes out of the 60 needed, or even less, you might embolden some no votes. You might embolden, a yes vote to vote no the next time. So, Harris was very calculated in that.
And it's a classic example of people who are on the outside. These are, a lot of the people who have been very fired up about same-sex marriage are probably, not steeped in the day-to-day of the budgets and everything else that makes up most of the work here in Springfield. They're passionate about this one issue, like a lot of voters might be about abortion or some other issue that gets them fired up. And so, yeah, they don't understand how the process works, but Representative Harris does. And he's a very careful and deliberate legislator and, very quiet. And he actually gave, I thought, one of the most calm and measured speeches during the debate. He did not have a lot of emotion. He certainly cares about this issue deeply, but, he was not fired up and pounding the desk. He was just very measured, as he's been all along throughout this process.
And I understand this particular debate on the floor really was quiet on the House floor. And those who aren't there, most of the time when there's debate going on, it's pretty much everybody else is having a conversation while the debate is taking place. That was not the case this time around, John O'Connor?
No, it truly was. You have those debates on very important issues when everyone's listening. Everyone has a stake in it. Everyone knows that the vote is very close, and they're going to actually. Many times, you're correct, Bill, that conversations go on, and it's like a schoolroom sometimes with the presiding officer hitting the gavel and
hitting the gavel and going shh.
Yeah, saying, take your conversations to the back. And one of my colleagues said when Lou Lang was in the chair last spring at one point. We heard Lou Lang at the top of the hour. He's one of the leaders on the Democratic side in the House. And one of my colleagues, you know, he was admonishing the House to be quiet during one debate. And one of my colleagues said, "Don't make me turn this chamber around." But this debate, you know, those are votes that are being taken when everyone knows how they're going to vote, or it's not an issue that's, you know, going to be make or break for a lot of people. And there are those issues such as gay marriage, and we'll probably see it again when there's a pension vote, if we ever get to a pension vote. When people are truly listening to the debate, people are on the fence. They, some of them really don't know until they push that button whether they're going to be yes or no, and they want to see what the debate is and how the feelings are among other representatives.
Should mention that the governor was in the chamber for this. Attorney General Lisa Madigan was in the chamber for this. Controller Judy Bart-Topinka, who's one of the handful of Republicans who is in favor of same-sex marriage. So there were a lot of constitutional officers in the chamber for the debate as well.
And as I understand on this particular issue, am I correct in saying that while it passed with two votes to spare, there may have been others who might have been willing to be a yes vote if needed?
I mean, that's typically how these things work. I don't know if anyone else has a better sense of the exact roll call. I mean, people play these things pretty close to the vest. But, I mean, I think generally, you know, you want to get, for something that's this controversial from a political standpoint, you want to have as few of your vulnerable people vote for it as possible. Maybe if somebody chickens out or doesn't go the right way or bucks their orders, so to speak, at the last minute, then you'd have somebody in your back pocket who could step in. But I'm just not sure.
This wasn't a situation where the board was, you know, flipping every which way. There are some votes where you see people clearly change the button from red to green or green to red, depending on how above or low it sails beyond the point needed. But this was something that was not that sort of situation. There may have been people watching the board to make sure it got that much and could have come in at the last minute, but there wasn't a lot of flip-flopping.
It got to 60 pretty quickly. I wasn't on the floor, but you listen to the presiding officer on something that is very crucial like this. The presiding officer will hold the roll, and those people, you know, will say, maybe they've given a promise to the speaker, "I'll vote yes if you need my vote." So they see that the board's at 59, and then, you know, they'll wait a few moments and then vote. But this one was called fairly quickly. So
yeah, he rushed. You know, there's a formal moment when the presiding officer says, "Have all voted to wish, have all voted to wish, have all voted to wish, take the record." And he kind of rushed it through this time to kind of lock it in, make sure that nobody, you know, chickened out at the last minute. And it ultimately had 61 votes. You need 60 to get something through. So it was a squeaker.
Now, the law takes effect when Governor Quinn signs it later this month, takes effect June 1st. There is an effort out there, Amanda Venicky, to move that date up to January. Does that have any chance of flying?
You know, it very well may. The Senate president, for example, says that he backs that move. Anybody who is an advocate for this would be ostensibly in favor of it. The sponsor of the measure that would move the date up says, you know, why make couples wait an extra 6 months or so? That sponsor, Senator Don Harmon, said and explains basically he's using a bill that is otherwise dead, so it could quickly move through the legislature, and the General Assembly would have to wait until January. Their new calendar published doesn't have them back in January until the end of that month. He gave the date again, for example, of Valentine's Day, maybe move it up till then. That said, you are coming into a political dicey zone. There are people who may have voted for it, but are not out there issuing press releases and shouting it from the rooftops. They are more quiet about their advocacy. There are people, you know, again, Pat Quinn, for example, this is for him a political plus. He worked for it. It plays well with Democrats. And so he will say, yes, I have a huge role. That's why he's having a big event November 20th, a bill signing in Chicago where he wants presumably thousands of people to be able to attend. There were about 1,000 people that came to the bill signing of the civil unions bill signing a couple years back. So it has not been determined if that will actually go forth. Democrats may not want their vulnerable members to once again have another very public roll call about this.
This is State Week. In review, just ahead, pensions and Governor Quinn's running mate.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, whose activities include proposing and shaping legislation, educating the public, and supporting the courts and the rule of law. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Amanda Venicky, and John O'Connor of the Associated Press. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Well, pensions were not dealt with this past week at the state capitol, although everyone leaves open the option that we could return to Springfield sometime yet this calendar year to deal with pensions at the capitol. Anybody have a feel for that?
They're talking about many lawmakers said that they had heard that they might be back the week of, well, on December 5th, which I believe is a Thursday thereabouts, but it's also after the filing date for a primary election. So, you know, those who are running for election next fall in 2014 will know who their primary opponents are, and they won't be forced to take any key votes before that date for people who might oppose them are required to file.
And the, where we stand now is that we've heard that there's been reporting, I should say, that the legislative leaders. So we've talked a lot this, the, you know, starting back in the summer, there was this conference committee of senators and representatives, Democrats and Republicans, that met together to try and come up with some kind of compromise. And then about a week or two ago, it kind of got kicked upstairs, so to speak. And we've heard the legislative leaders have been meeting. This is House Speaker Mike Madigan, Senate President John Cullerton, and the two Republican leaders. And kind of, you know, once they're involved, it signals to the outside world, at least, that, I mean, people are taking this a little bit more seriously now. And we've heard that they have a possible proposal that they have sent out to be scored. So they've sent it to these actuaries who are going to look at it and decide how much money it saves. You know, whether it saves enough money to satisfy people who, you know, who want to see a more harsh plan that would take, you know, more benefits away from retirees, or whether it's, you know, meets the constitutionality requirements that we've heard some people more concerned about than others, Senate President Cullerton in particular, that remains to be seen. We don't know that there's a deal yet, and nobody I talked to, including Senate President Cullerton, you know, was willing to commit, but, I mean, we're just kind of waiting right now.
Well, I think there was significant movement in a sense, and it was totally overshadowed by the other stuff that went on this week, particularly the same-sex marriage bill. But the legislature approved changes to the pension plan for the Chicago Park District and its employees. And those changes involve having workers work longer, having the cost of living adjustment reduced, having workers pay more into the system. And the principles involved there, you work longer, you pay more, you get less, those are at the heart of the reforms that the conference committee and the leaders are talking about. And there's a big question whether the language in the Constitution, which says membership in any public employee retirement system is a contractual relationship, and the benefits shall not be diminished or impaired, it's pretty clear language. Whether or not that language counts ultimately will be decided by the Supreme Court. And so the bill now on its way to Governor Quinn for the Park District could well be a test case, because as soon as that bill is signed, a suit will be filed, and it will be filed in the circuit court. The circuit court will come down with a ruling. Whoever loses the ruling will appeal, and they'll probably ask the Supreme Court to hear the appeal without having to go through the appellate court level, just as happened with the governor's line item veto of legislative salaries. And so this is a way to get a case before the justices to find out once and for all whether, in fact, we can unilaterally cut people's benefits, despite the clear language of the Constitution that seems to say that we can't.
But you don't think, Charlie, that while waiting on that court decision, that the legislature will wait to see what happens. You think they may?
Oh, no. I think the political pressure is such that they have to do something. But on the other hand, here's something that is now on its way to the Supreme Court. And meanwhile, while the leaders negotiate, while the conference committee does its work, the ball is already in motion to find out if their efforts are going to be fruitful or not. They may well wind up passing something, and before it can get to the Supreme Court rules on the Park District, and they find out that what they've done is okay or it's not okay. And if it's not okay, it saved them time to come back and try and fashion something that will pass constitutional muster.
I just wonder if the timing here is not kind of short. I mean, if the legislature really does come back on December 5th and pass some sort of pension overhaul that has similar to this, I don't know what, you know, what necessarily the benefit would be to sending this, you know, Park District case up as opposed to just taking the full case. Maybe it'd be consolidated. I just don't know. I mean, the courts move very slowly, as you well know, Charlie. And I wonder if they're, you know, I don't know that we would actually get any sort of ruling that would help the lawmakers in their deliberations that they're doing now. And there is such, like you mentioned, there's such intense political pressure. The governor has staked his reputation on you know, in his reelection in some sense, on being able to get something done on pensions. We saw one of his opponents already putting out, you know, statements criticizing the governor for not, you know, getting the pension thing done during this veto session. I mean, this is still such a hot issue. I don't know if anyone has an appetite to wait for guidance from the Supreme Court.
Oh, no, they're not going to wait, but they'll go ahead and do something. But I'm of the opinion that everything they're talking about so far is unconstitutional. And the sooner there's a definitive ruling on that, the sooner they can get down to addressing the issue in a way that will actually produce results. And if they pass a pension plan in December, it will be in the same situation as the gay marriage bill, in that they're not going to have three-fifths majorities in both chambers to make it effective immediately. It will become effective on June 1st. So you're waiting the equivalent of 5 months or more before you can even get this thing, the court cases underway.
And moving from that topic, now we have Governor Pat Quinn announcing on Friday that Paul Vallis would be his running mate, a surprise announcement for some. Vallis, former Chicago school CEO and a former gubernatorial candidate himself, will be the running mate for Quinn. Amanda Venicky?
This was a surprise because there had been a lot of thought that the governor would try and pick a woman or a minority, perhaps an African-American, to reach out to that very important voting block. And instead, you have a white male who, for critics, brings with him some controversy, did not get a lot of the downstate vote in 2002, and that's part of what contributed to, lo and behold, Rod Blagojevich winning the governorship at that point in time. And, of course, that's how he got Lieutenant Governor at the time, Pat Quinn, to be his running mate, so kind of an interesting role reversal there. Also questions, it seems, about Paul Vallis and his residency, seeing as he's been working in as a superintendent of a large school district in Connecticut, and he's faced residency questions there as well that have led to troubles. So, and I'll add another residency issue for Vallis, when in 2006, after it was clear Blagojevich had some political issues and a lot of media reporting that on corruption within the Blagojevich administration. So, but that prevented Vallis from making a political comeback then. The governor, in his statement, saying that he believes that he's known Paul Vallis for 30 years. Vallis has, quote, never been shy about fighting for education, reform, and opportunities for working people. We've made great progress these last few years, but serious challenges remain. Our mission is not yet accomplished. So Paul Vallis is definitely one that I think admirers of this choice will say has a long history in state politics. A lot of people, you know, looking back at 2002 and saying, gosh, if only he had won against Blagojevich then.
John O'Connor, back in 1995, when lawmakers, a Republican-controlled legislature, was passing Chicago school overhaul at that time, They treated Paul Vallis as a saint when they said he would be the CEO for the schools. And so he had the praise of Republicans. And throughout that, I think those Republican business leaders that fight for education issues and want to see changes support somebody like a Paul Vallis, do they not?
They do. They certainly did then. The history there is that I believe there was no break between when Vallis became CEO of the Chicago Public Schools and when he was director of what was then known as the Economic and Fiscal Commission, which is the legislature's budgeting and budget forecasting arm. He's a numbers guy at heart, and he is a straight shooter. He has a reputation as a straight shooter, and very intelligent and very bare knuckled, down to basics kind of guy. And so I think that's what engendered such support for him among both Democrats and Republicans. And that's what he took to the Chicago Public Schools, is that no-nonsense approach. And he promoted the fact that he had labor peace and, no strikes among teachers, which for 4 or 5 years running, when that was up until that point an almost annual thing. So he worked as an administrator. He was able to work with labor. And he had a balanced budget, at least, that's what he claimed for 4 or 5 years running. So he certainly has the pedigree and certainly has enjoyed wide bipartisan support over the years.
One thing, too, Charlie Wheeler, why would somebody of Vallis's stature want to be lieutenant governor when he has been always in do-something jobs and a lot of control and has had his hands in? Is he going to be, if Quinn were to win, is he, in your mind, going to be set to change a lot with schools?
That would be the assumption. I mean, you don't know what went on in the private conversations between the two men before Quinn made the offer, Vallis accepted the offer. But I assume, given Paul's resume, that Quinn would be looking for him to be a leader on education, as he has been. I've known Paul Vallis for, oh my goodness, probably 30 or more years, back to the time when he was the Democratic staffer for the Senate Revenue Committee and worked with the late Don Clark Netsch. And as John said, he's a very good detail guy, very good on the numbers, and he has this passion for education. So I would suspect, because the lieutenant governor has kind of a wide open portfolio, it's whatever the governor says the lieutenant governor should be doing, my guess is that the arrangement would be Paul Vallis would be the face of the administration on education reform as we go forward with the Common Core, as we fight to provide adequate funding for schools. There's a lot of issues there that I think Vallis is very well qualified to deal with.
And unfortunately, we are out of time. We will have to talk about that some more next week. That is our time for this edition of State Week. Thanks to John O'Connor of the Associated Press as a guest. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or if using a desktop or laptop, find it on iTunes by searching for State Week in Review. Production assistance for our program today was provided by Senta Sieber. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.